This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, March 16th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. Forgive this commercial for our monthly audio product, Cato Audio. In the roundtable for the March edition of Cato Audio, I spoke with Cato Vice President Chris Preble about his new book for libertarianism.org, Peace, War, and Liberty. The book considers the past, present, and future of U.S. foreign policy. This roundtable is a monthly staple of our Cato Audio program, available wherever you get your podcasts. History does not stand still, and the United States, with regard to its interactions with countries around the world, is long and checkered and embarrassing and triumphant and a lot of different things. And of course, everything leads to the next thing with respect to foreign policy, and a lot has changed very recently. So we're talking with Chris Preble, Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, who has authored a new book on behalf of Cato's libertarianism.org project, Peace, War, and Liberty, Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy. Chris, you're solo here on the Cato Audio Roundtable.
I am.
So to begin here, what are the most important elements to understand about foreign policy as understood by the founders, and what they viewed in those early years as the proper role of this new country in the world?
Right. So thanks for having me, Caleb. It's been a great project to work on with the folks at Libertarianism, and you know, it's given me an opportunity. I'm a historian by training, and it's given me an opportunity to sort of talk about U.S. history and then relate it to the present day. And if you go back and you look at how the founders thought about foreign policy, what they wrote, they were quite anxious that wars, or the danger that the United States would become involved in wars, would grow the power of the state. Even folks like George Washington, a military man himself, was quite adamant that overgrown military establishments, as he called them in his farewell address, would be a threat to liberty.
You quote James Madison here in the early chapter. He's at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He wrote, "The means of defense against foreign danger have been always the instruments of tyranny at home. Among the Romans, it was a standing maxim to excite a war whenever a revolt was apprehended. Throughout all Europe, the armies kept under the pretext of defending have enslaved the people."
Right. So again, the founders' views on standing armies and on military establishments were clear, and they were informed by history, not just recent history, but ancient history. And so I think what's striking to me about the Constitution in particular is it did create a stronger federal government than the Articles of Confederation, and part of the reason for that was a concern about the ability of the individual states, as effectively sovereign states, to defend themselves against one another and foreign threats. And so the Constitution did create a stronger federal government with the ability to, through union, better defend against foreign threats. And yet, despite that, the Constitution also includes some very clear limits on the ability of the federal government to mobilize resources for war. It does it by, for example, limiting appropriations for the army and requiring Congress to come back to the people repeatedly to fund the army, which effectively prohibits, a standing army itself. They did allow for the reference, of course, is to raising an army. They did allow for a navy to be maintained, but they saw the navy as much less of a threat to liberty in the same way that standing armies were. They also, of course, wanted the Congress to have to vote on matters of war and peace, that the power to go to war was vested with the Congress, not with the executive branch. And they fully expected that, you know, if it were necessary for the United States to mobilize to repel foreign threats, then the Congress would vote for it and reflect the will of the people of a willingness to undertake this and raise the funds necessary to prosecute the war to a successful end.
The military, of course, is very different today than at the times when muskets were distributed and purchased, and was a craftsman's product, the musket. Mm-hmm. But we live in a world where we do have a standing army.
Yes.
War powers have been viewed as, by many people, as almost inherently executive in a very fundamental, powerful way.
Yes.
You referred again to Madison, and he said there is no greater wisdom than the delegation of war powers to the legislative branch.
Yeah.
But it's
he actually called it the most important clause of the document.
So Madison specifically, was he concerned that an overweening executive would seek out these powers and seek to aggrandize these powers, or was he concerned that the legislature would abdicate? Because that seems to be where we are now. It's like there's an extent to which, because I remember Barack Obama saying, I have the power to do this, but I'm going to be kind and ask Congress to approve.
Right. When we're recording this, recently, Congress did sort of exercise its authority in a very sort of odd way, or I shouldn't say odd way. It is odd, but the reporting at the time said that it was a unique and rare act of defiance on the part of Congress to affirm. I can't even say it without laughing. It's absurd to affirm its constitutional obligation. This is an act of defiance. That's how far we've come. I think that Madison believed that the branches would balance against one another and that they would be jealous of their powers and prerogatives. And I think that hasn't happened, and it happens less and less. The part that he somewhat anticipated, and you can see this in Federalist 10, but not to the same extent that it's happened, the parties and partisanship have eroded the three branches and their sense of sort of responsibility and balance, such that it is now quite routine for Republican members to support wars started by Republican presidents, and the same thing with Democrats. But generally, sort of leaving partisanship aside, generally an unwillingness on the part of members of Congress to affirm and assert their prerogatives under the Constitution.
Of course, war is not the only thing that engages foreign policy. Of course, we here at the Cato Institute like to point out that free trade is one of the most powerful weapons, if you will, on behalf of peace.
Yes.
But with respect to interventions in other countries, how has the understanding of the role of the United States changed in our 200 plus years?
Well, it's changed very dramatically. I think that the key sort of frame of reference that I always go back to is something that the historian Walter McDougall teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, sets up as a distinction between the Old and New Testament. Under the Old Testament vision of the United States' role in the world, the United States would set itself up as an example for others and create a system of government that provided benefits to the people through liberty and to allow them to build, you know, prosperous, fulfilling lives, and that other countries would wish to be like us. We were, the city on the hill. We were the new Israel, is the way it was described at the time. And I think those ideas held for most of the first 100 plus years of American history. The second act, as it were, is more like the New Testament, where the United States is a crusading spirit. It's not enough to be simply the example to others, but that we would go and promote actively around the world. That was a very dramatic departure from America's founding traditions. The most famous speech of the sort of reflecting this early sentiment is John Quincy Adams' speech on 4th of July, 1821. That's the speech in which he said, "The United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy." And yet, by the early 20th century, the United States did, of course, become involved in a number of foreign conflicts, and then progressively more so as the 20th century wore on, such that now, in 2018, the United States is actively engaged in at least, in at least seven different places, and arguably the war on terror encompasses effectively the entire planet. And so quite literally, in a constant state of war and military intervention.
In your chapter on the world wars and their lessons, you write, "Alas, the confident predictions that commerce would reduce war to obsolescence seem hopelessly naive when juxtaposed against the human carnage that occurred during the first half of the 20th century." So was that actually a mistake to believe that commerce would dramatically reduce war? Was it overstated simply?
It was overstated. I think that it's wrong to accuse folks like, it wasn't just someone like Norman Angell, but also Cobden and Bright, who led the Anti-Corn Law League in Great Britain in the mid-19th century, who believed that trade would be a vehicle for peace. John Stuart Mill wrote about it as well. Obviously, Immanuel Kant. These people argued that war was costly and risky, and that the gains to trade could deliver benefits vastly greater than the gains that were acquired, like, you know, through most of human history, which is you take other people's stuff. That's not the way that it, you know, human history has evolved, thankfully. And Angell, who wrote before the First World War, that that war, you know, would simply didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for countries to believe they could get rich by conquest. And he was right in the sense that the war started, but those who initiated the war believed it, World War I, believed it would end quickly with a decisive victory. It obviously did not. And I think the lesson of the 20th century is that these massive world wars, great power wars, are extraordinarily costly, and the benefits are fleeting, if at all. Add to that now the presence of nuclear weapons, which raises the cost of aggression astronomically, right? That the benefits that would accrue to a country that takes on a nuclear armed state seem quite small when confronted with the risk of total annihilation. And so, I think that there are a number of factors that explain the absence of great power conflict since 1945. That is not to say that wars have ended. They certainly have not. It is not to say that great power conflict is impossible. It is possible. And yet, I think many people understand that the cost and benefit equation is vastly in favor of defense as opposed to offense.
So is it appropriate to think of war as being about resources? Because if we think of trade as, delivering these tremendous gains, and as nuclear weapons being used only as this last resort, because, if you're there to take stuff, there's not much stuff to take if you
in an irradiated hellscape.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah, I think that if we perceive that trade or gain or greed, as Hobbes put it, is the primary driver of warfare, then trade really does drain away from it. But of course, drain away sort of the appeal of war. But of course, countries also go to war for matters of prestige and honor and glory and those sorts of things. And those are less pronounced also than they were hundreds of years ago, but they still exist. Countries and people still resist, foreigners imposing on them their will and sometimes desire to impose it on others. And so I think you have to allow for the fact that war is caused by things other than just greed.
Between the end of World War II and 9/11, we still had also pretty dramatic shifts in how Americans view foreign policy.
Yes.
A lot of the Vietnam experience, I think, left a lot of Americans with a general profound distaste for war.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, war has become less costly, in a sense, with respect to humans.
Right.
That is, throwing a lot of human beings at a conflict is... we don't have to do that as much anymore.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I wrote about this last year, sort of comparing the various war memorials, of which there are now many, on the National Mall. We Americans have, or the United States, I should say, U.S. troops have done the fighting. Americans have mostly watched. Since 9/11, war is now into the 18th year in Afghanistan, and the total number of Americans killed in those 18 years is a bit over 7,000. The number of names carved in the Vietnam Memorial in black granite is over 58,000. It seems inconceivable today to imagine a conflict like Vietnam that is so costly in terms of human lives, and American lives. Something perhaps as many as 3 million Vietnamese were killed in the Vietnam War. But the fact that we do not have Americans dying in these conflicts nearly on the scale that they did in Korea and Vietnam does not mean that these wars are short or actually they're quite long, right? They're being fought in a way that, as you note, sort of separates most Americans from having to consider these costs, and so we are on a sort of autopilot, as it were, it seems.
Since 9/11. The United States has, hastily passed authorizations for the use of force, which, is that different or the same as a declaration of war?
It's not the same as a declaration of war. It's not. We have not had a declaration of war since World War II.
All right. So since then, we've had multiple authorizations of the use of force that were essentially open-ended.
Yes.
But even those relatively open-ended declarations, authorizations, have been stretched so far beyond
right.
the original intention. I mean,
right.
it's to the point where we're using declarations meant to fight Al-Qaeda to fight ISIS, an avowed enemy of Al-Qaeda.
Correct. So, I mean, I'm glad you framed this. So, of course, the Korean War was not fought under a declaration of war. It was, called a police action or something along those lines. But imagine under the rubric of the Tonkin Gulf resolution, Lyndon Johnson claiming the right to send U.S. troops into Zimbabwe, for example. There's something just utterly absurd about that. And yet, under the authorization to use military force passed immediately after 9/11 and the subsequent authorization pertaining to war in Iraq in 2002, it is not inconceivable that U.S. military personnel could be sent to virtually any place on the planet under the guise of one or both of those AUMFs.
So moving forward, it seems that, as we mentioned earlier, we have a standing army. The executive has been aggrandized with respect to war powers.
Yes.
The ability for a sitting U.S. president to engage in hostilities around the planet is, in some sense, unlimited.
Yes.
So how do we get back to what you would view as an appropriate role for the United States throughout the globe?
Right. So this material in the book sort of continues on the work that I did 10 years ago in The Power Problem and sort of lays out a set of criteria that I think that Americans, all Americans, but especially those Americans who are entrusted with the responsibility to oversee these things, that is, our elected officials in Congress, because the United States is a wealthy country. We are a large country. We are a powerful country. We will have the ability to use force on a moment's notice, virtually no matter what we do. I don't dispute that. That is going to happen. But precisely because we have that power, it's incumbent upon U.S. officials and sort of frankly, all Americans to sort of consider whenever someone proposes that the U.S. military be deployed to a particular place, to ask some very specific questions about what is the mission, how long will it last, how much will it cost, what are the prospects for actual victory, are the American people sufficiently supportive of this mission that they can sustain it as long as necessary? We just don't ask these questions anymore. We just become involved militarily, and then effectively the president dares the Congress to cut off the funds for the troops, which they don't do. So I think it really is about sort of turning the question of intervention back to why, as opposed to why not. Because we can is not a sufficient answer. We always can. And I think American presidents have figured this out quickly. And even those who from time to time resisted it, including most recently Barack Obama and Donald J. Trump, even when they might be inclined to resist it, they are often surrounded by people or buffeted by the various cable news networks on all the places where they should be intervening, where U.S. troops could be making a difference, where the United States' honor and prestige is sufficiently engaged that requires us to do more. And they need a set of criteria. We all need a set of criteria to sort of assess whether or not that is the appropriate policy, because, and I want to emphasize this, because there are many instruments of American power and influence besides the U.S. military. You know, I served in the military. I'm proud of it. It is an outstanding institution, and the people who serve in it deserve our respect. And yet, they are only one set of the military are only one set of tools or instruments of U.S. power, and we have to be more confident in the other things that the United States can and has done to spread liberty and to spread the vision of the good life, and that. Other technique, the other methods that we use are precisely those that were favored by the founders, that the United States should create a society that others wish to emulate, and that we should be consistent, and we should speak to these principles and adhere to these principles. And I think if we did that, the world would be, frankly, not merely a safer place, that is, fewer wars, but also a freer place.
So that is great. As an aspiration,
yes.
I have a lot of high regard for that. But you know, there are incentives built into the structure of our government. There are incentives that are built into how media gets distributed today. The fiscal policy,
yes.
Here in Washington, D.C. plays a role. To what extent has debt...
Yes.
The ability for the government to borrow, you know, endlessly more money,
right.
as we record this, the national debt just hit
$22 trillion.
Yes. To what extent does debt, you know, we're not throwing a lot of human beings, or I should say, we're not killing a lot of U.S. soldiers, relatively
yes.
speaking.
Yeah.
It still happens a lot, but it's dramatically smaller numbers.
Yes.
To what extent is the fact that there is no immediate consequence with respect to the federal budget, with
right.
respect to taxes, with respect to having to cut federal programs in order to fund this war?
Right.
How has that enabled war?
It has enabled it hugely. It is hard to overstate the importance of debt and deficit spending to prevent the advocates for war from spelling out to the American people what Americans will be expected to forego or what sacrifices they will be required to make in order to prosecute these wars. And let's be clear, even the long and seemingly interminable conflicts under the War on Terror have consumed trillions of dollars, but trillions of dollars over a period of time in which the U.S. economy has generated hundreds of trillions, more or less. You know, the total military spending in the United States is somewhere on the order of 3% of GDP and shrinking. So by those standards, it's easy enough for advocates for military spending to say this is tolerable. What's the problem? Well, the problem is that we're spending well beyond our means, that we are financing these wars and maintaining the ability to fight more of them on debt. And ultimately, some hard choices will have to be made, but those hard choices have so far been postponed or evaded. And I think that the Congress and the executive here are, you know, sort of joined together in not presenting to the American people the hard trade-offs between these things, which is why, by the way, many people are familiar with Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, military-industrial complex speech in January of 1961. I also include in the book a long speech that he gave called The Chance for Peace, which was one of the first speeches he gave as president in April of 1953. And in that speech, Eisenhower spells out the trade-offs. He spells out the opportunity costs. He explains to the American people, if you buy a ship, you can't buy a hospital. If you buy a plane, you can't buy this much wheat. That is precisely the discussion that we do not ever have in this country. And it's because when Eisenhower was saying this, people actually cared about debt and deficits. They allowed, you know, there were some of them, and we obviously went deep into debt to prosecute and win the World War II. And yet people like him cared deeply about fiscal balance. The number of people, it appears, who actually care about such things is small and shrinking. Thankfully, many of them are avid listeners to Cato Audio and generous sponsors to the Cato Institute, for which I'm immensely grateful. But I'll have to call them out. I can't help it. Mick Mulvaney, who's sort of the acting chief of staff now in the White House and a former congressman, but also former head of the Office of Management and Budget, was asked prior to the president's State of the Union address, will there be anything in here about a debt and deficits? And he effectively said, and no one cares about that anymore. And it was a shocking statement from a person who once at least did genuinely care about such things. And I think it tells us just how far we've come.
I want to close with this because I feel like this might be a hard case, and maybe it's not a hard case at all. Venezuela.
Mm.
The United States has had a wide and varied relationship with Venezuela over the past 30 plus years.
Yes.
Right. They're not very far away.
Yes.
So the potential for something going bad in Venezuela could affect the U.S. in a significant way.
Yes.
There are people there who are trying to assert liberties that they once possessed in Venezuela. They are essentially, in a sense, freedom fighters.
Yes.
And they are taking on a government that has, over the last 10 years or so, has really just ratcheted up the control and has left the vast majority of Venezuelans dramatically poorer and less free.
Correct.
What is the U.S. role in a country like Venezuela? Is it even appropriate for the U.S. to say, we recognize this person as having won the election and is the new rightful leader of this country? Is it in a sort of a back channel way trying to support the people who are fighting against the government?
Right.
Or is it just to stand back and just let things play out?
I think there is a critical distinction between the United States recognizing a person who can point to the Venezuelan constitution and the laws within Venezuela and sort of make a case for why they are the legitimate, why he or she is the legitimate leader of Venezuela, in this case, Juan Guaido, versus Nicolas Maduro. The problem with the Venezuela case right now is that we are also aware of multiple instances in which the United States government actively worked with elements within Venezuela, including at least three different occasions where U.S. government officials met with military officers in the Venezuelan military who were contemplating a coup against the Maduro government. Other incidents in which the United States met with opposition figures. And that to me seems like a kind of meddling in the affairs of a sovereign state that if it were done to us, we would object. And I think it's worth just sort of taking a step back, leaving aside the history of U.S. involvement in the domestic politics of many states in our hemisphere over the last three quarters of a century or so, a little bit longer than that, actually. What upsets me most about the way the Venezuela story is playing out is the suggestion that liberals in Venezuela, classical liberals, even libertarians, if you will, who desire a state that is respectful of rights and property and human rights and free speech and all of those things, that they can't possibly prevail without the covering fire of American armaments or the threat of the use of force. And as a libertarian, I find that suggestion, frankly, repugnant. These ideas that we believe in are good and they work and they don't require the United States military to be promoting them by force. They don't require the United States government to be picking and choosing the winners of who will prevail in a foreign election. So I do talk about this in the closing passages of the book talk about the importance of seeing human liberty as springing from many sources, not just from the United States of America. And I think that's the kind of world that I want to live in.
All right. The book published by libertarianism.org at the Cato Institute is Peace, War, and Liberty: Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy. The author is the Cato Institute's Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies, Chris Preble. The book will be available very soon, in the next month, in fact, and you can get your copy at cato.org. Chris Preble is author of Peace, War, and Liberty, Understanding U.S. Foreign Policy, available now for pre-order. This discussion was part of our monthly Cato audio program, available as a podcast everywhere. And you can, of course, follow the Cato Daily Podcast on Twitter at Cato Podcast.